So in Thay's letter, he introduced Ananda's deep vow from the Surigama Sutra, and also Master Dison's My Aspiration Chant. And both of these express the same aspiration. And it is the aspiration that is taken up by every sincere practitioner in order to see through the veil of suffering, the illusion of dukkha, so that we can help all beings. That's a seed that we talked about last Sunday. But in his letter, Thay goes on to say that even though vows are chanted, recited, memorized, and spoken every day, the majority of people practicing still don't realize and actualize their dream. He said 95% get caught in wanting to be something, wanting to be recognized or praised, wanting to be an abbot, wanting to be a Dharma teacher, grasping after something, and they fail to lift the veil. This is Thay's way of telling us that aspiration, even though true and deep aspiration, it isn't enough. Why is this so? Because the seed of our aspiration has to sprout and take root in practice, actual practice, not just our ideas about practice, but actually practicing. So there's a Buddha that was introduced in the Avatamsaka Sutra called Vairochana. And in Vairochana's Dharma, he speaks about the seven attributes of an ideal meditation posture. Vairochana is the pure and clear mind. And so, of course, meditation is his practice. And what he says constitutes the ideal posture for meditation is the adamantine sitting, which is solid. Ideally, cross-legged on the floor, but certainly not necessary at all. Casting eyes down, not closing them. Keeping backbone straight, shoulders level, tucking the chin, and just letting your tongue rest against the back of your upper teeth. And then placing your hands in the position, the mudra of meditation. And it's important whenever we sit down that we take that posture. If we're sitting in a chair, then we have the stability of three points of our feet and our buttocks. But not the point of our back touching the back of the chair. We need to sit in such a way that we are upright without our back touching the back of the chair. And you can feel that. And it's important to find that posture for yourself. And that's, it's really natural. You just come back into your body, and that's right where we start. With our sitting, is in our body, in our breath. And so the first thing is to come to our body, check our three points, that diamond of grounding, our uprightness, our relaxed shoulders, our head not back, not dropping. Really important not to let our head drop or go forward. And if we find that we can't sit like that because our muscles or our chest is contracted or our neck is stiff, then we have to do something that helps us to get to that posture. Sometimes lying on the floor really flat and then just letting our chest fall open. Or thinking of, a string pulling up on our chest. And then just letting our neck be right in line with that spine. So it's important that we take that position. And when we put our hands in the mudra, it's right in front of our belly, and there's a circle in our arms. There's a circle in our fingers. And there's a circle in our breath. And we're immediately in the midst of the circle of the day, the circle of the week, the circle of the seasons, the circle of the earth. And we're held there. And that's a lovely position, because then we can let go. And that's what we have to be doing. We have to keep letting go of our ideas, letting go of our thinking, letting go of our worrying and planning. So we bring from that position, it's very easy to bring ourselves to our breath and allow ourselves to be completely open. So we're hearing sounds. We're in our body. We're in the circle of our life. And if we start with that level of awareness, and then we say our aspiration, already then we are in a very wonderful place of meditation. As our aspiration says, and as the Buddha said, we do this in order to be able to look into suffering. But the word the Buddha used was dukkha. In our translation of the Heart Sutra, which comes from Thai, it's called ill-being. And my other teacher, Eiken Roshi, called it angst. So let's take apart the word dukkha a bit. The first syllable, duk, means hard or difficult. And ka is the axle of a wheel. So dukkha points to a bumpy ride. And indeed, when we're suffering, it is a bumpy ride. It's unpleasant, and we do what we can to escape it. We have all sorts of techniques that we've developed through our whole life for escaping it. I want to say there are no techniques for meditation, but there are lots of techniques for escaping dukkha. Blaming others. Seeking pleasure. Blaming the world. There's too many billionaires. There's too many poor people. Women, dark-skinned people are discriminated against. The environment is being trashed. When I started out my career in the working world, I was working as an environmentalist, as an Arctic alpine ecologist, and I was working in the Arctic in the 70s, studying an indicator species for the well-being of, that indicated the well-being of that ecosystem at the very same time that gravel roads were being laid across the tundra, the pipeline was being built, and the very first wells were being dug in the Arctic Ocean. And it broke my heart. So I turned to meditation. And I discovered that true meditation practice, like the kind of practice that you all have been doing this week, not just a lot of techniques or ideas. But true meditation is an act of protest. It's a strong, active stance in the face of distraction, dissociation, and consumerism. Perhaps you've discovered this for yourself this week. If not, look. And this is looking deeply. And when we look that way, we find the energy to keep going. We find the energy to say, I will sit here and I won't escape anymore. I won't indulge myself. In our Bodhisattva's vow, Ananda's vow, becomes our own vow, arises spontaneously in our own heart. And because the hurt in the world is so deep, your hurt is so deep, my hurt is so deep, I vow to learn how to stay present, how to hold them, how to hold it, how to transform it. And then we simply take up the simplest of practices, letting go of our ideas, letting go of our concepts, letting go of our thoughts, our perceptions, our feelings, our self-identification. We have an anchor. We focus our mind, our breath, with hearing sounds, with our awareness of body, so that we can know when thoughts and emotions are arising. Vairochana said, we sit so deep that we can hear the sound of wood preaching underwater words. That's essential. We have to have a teacher who will keep reminding us of who we really are. And will keep pointing the way when we get lost. And we have to have a community. You know, if you were at home this week, would you have been eating like this? Would you have been walking like this? Would you have been sitting like this? Could you do it? Would you do it on your own? I don't think we can do it. I don't think any one of us could. I couldn't. After 40 years of practice, I couldn't do it without you. And we also have to have an ethical grounding. That's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So Thay talks about the five skandhas, and we encounter them over and over again in our sutras. The five skandhas, skanda sometimes is translated as aggregate, and it's like aggregate means like a whole that's formed from several different elements. And the aggregates are form, feelings, perceptions, mental reactions, and consciousness. And if we look at our form, any form, you know, we can see that we're made up of toes and knees and intestines and hearts, brains, and eyeballs. And our feelings are also made up of, well, we say heart and we say I mean, truly, actually, what feelings means here is good, bad, and neutral. And actually, let me just say a little bit about that. When we're paying attention, to what's coming up, when we see what's there, usually before we identify anything as a thought or an emotion, we've already said to ourselves, I like this, I don't like this, or it doesn't matter. You know, there's already a reaction happening, you know, before it even is to the surface of our consciousness. And so when we can pay attention at that level, then before the thought has even arisen, we can let it go. We can not get caught in good or bad or neutral. Before a perception has ever even been identified as a perception, we have made a judgment with it. It's really important at some point to be that precise in our meditation, to know that. Anyway, all the five skandhas are aggregates. They're made up of other things, and they come together to make something as well. And all the skandhas, all the aggregates, are conditioned. They are based upon the conditions that are present. Things that are present right now. Take, for example, thoughts. If we just pay attention to our thoughts, we don't identify them as ourself, so we don't have to figure them out. We don't have to analyze them. We don't have to fix ourselves because of them. We don't have to get rid of them. They just arise and they pass away. There is nothing innate or inherent in their existence. So why cling to them? Bodhidharma was the ancestor that brought Zen Buddhism to China. And there's a wonderful story about Bodhidharma and his first disciple, Huiko. Huiko came to Bodhidharma and he stood outside Bodhidharma's cave and he really, really wanted to practice. And Bodhidharma was staring at the wall and he wouldn't give Huiko the time of day. And so Huiko sat outside the cave in the snow and the freezing cold. And Bodhidharma didn't pay any attention to him at all. And Huiko, finally, to get Bodhidharma's attention, cut off his arm. And then Bodhidharma realized how sincere he was in his practice. I will give anything. I will give anything to be here with you. And so Bodhidharma said, "What is your question?" And Huiko said, "I want to find peace of mind." And Bodhidharma said, "Well, bring me your mind and I will pacify it." And Huiko went away and he practiced and he practiced. And finally he came back to Bodhidharma and he said, "I have looked everywhere and I cannot find my mind." And Bodhidharma says, "There, it is pacified." Pay attention to your thoughts, but let them go. Open the hand of thought. Don't push them away, just let them go. If you believe in them, if you hold on to them, if you grasp them, you will have a bumpy ride. And that's what the Buddha says. Every thought, feeling, perception, mental reaction arises from conditions. So there are many conditions. There are the conditions of our family, of our background. And we tend to want to come to meditation and sit on the cushion and take care of that, you know, like resolve or transform what happened in the past. And so we come with a story. This happened, and I feel this way because of that, and I act that way because of this. That's how conditioning works. This is because that is. We've heard that a few times. That's conditioning. And what I say is, you know, on your cushion, don't try to figure things out. Don't try to analyze things. Don't try to fix yourself. If you have things from your past you want to resolve, go to therapy. Therapy is a wonderful tool that we have available to us in the modern world. And it helps us then to resolve and come to some level of peace with the conditions of our family. So Some of it happens through practice too. But practice is not to do that. That is not the reason we come to practice. And it's one of the things that's very misunderstood in American Buddhism. We think we come to a retreat. In fact, there was this one sangha that I led retreats at, and they would send out a questionnaire before the retreat. What do you want to work on in this retreat? And then they would give me these slips, and I would go, work on it, for heaven's sake. What methods do you have, and what techniques do you have for me to work on this? Please don't work on it. Please don't. There's also cultural conditioning and group conditioning. I mean, that's how someone like Hitler can arise. You know, we hear something. We think it'll take care of something for us, even though we aren't sure it's true. It allows us to belong, so we join with the group, even though it's not true to our experience. And there becomes a group mentality, a cultural perspective that gets perpetuated and supported by stories, words, thoughts, gossip. It gets beat up. You know, that's what Hitler was able to do, is to get people really beat up around things. And out of that, 6 million people were killed. Jews, homosexuals, artists. That can happen in our community as well. This is how groups get dangerous, because they create a right and a wrong, an inside and an outside, and us and a them. We have to be really careful about that in our sanghas. We have to be really careful about what we say and what we do and what we think, and not just try to go along to belong. And the Buddha said, and Thay says in his letter, we have to look with our own eyes. If someone tells us a pear is bitter and we listen, we may never know that that pear is sweet, that pear is nourishing, and it's helping us to understand. This is what Thay means about not getting indoctrinated. There once lived a priest named Rui Yan. And every morning when he'd wake up, he would call out, Master! And then he would answer himself, Yes. Then he would say to himself, Be awake. And he would reply, Yes. And then he would say, Don't be deceived by others. No. He would reply. What others is he, a master, talking about? What other exists within you? What other exists within your sangha? The sutras say conditioned mind tells us this is because that is. But when we're practicing deeply, when our mind is focused and concentrated, we let go of every conditioned thought, feeling, perception. Because the Buddha said conditioned thinking is the basis of dukkha. We read this yesterday in the Middle Way Sutra. Thay refers to it in his letter also. The cycle of conditioning. Because there is, and I would need the sutra book, and I will, because it's important. Because there's ignorance. There are impulses Because there are impulses, there is consciousness. Because there's consciousness, there's the psyche soma. Because there's a psyche soma, there are the six senses. Because there are the six senses, there's contact. Because there's contact, there's feeling. Because there's feeling, there's craving. Because there's craving, there's grasping. Because there's grasping, there's becoming. Because there is becoming, there is birth. Because there's birth, there are old age, death, grief, and sorrow. This is how the entire mass of suffering arises. Because we attach to our conditioning, it's a bumpy ride. There's suffering. There's dukkha. That's what the middle way says. And there's something more to see here. In our concentration, right in the middle of our condition, the condition right now, we come to see that there is nothing inherent or substantial or lasting. Only when we grasp do they become something. Only when we grasp our thoughts, get carried away with them. That's the other that the Master is talking about. Don't be deceived by others. Mother Teresa was once asked, "What do you say when you pray to God?" And she replied, "I don't say anything. I listen." And then they said, "Well, what does God say to you when you're listening to Him?" And she replied, "He doesn't say anything. He just listens." If you don't understand, I can't explain it to you. It is like this when we practice truly. We don't get caught anywhere. We see our root mind is unconditioned. The root of conditions is unconditioned. The conditioned mind says this is because that is. The unconditioned mind is this. The conditioned mind says, "Listen, listen, this wonderful sound brings me back to my true self." The unconditioned mind. Nothing more. Nothing else. Tai refers to this in his letter. He points to the Dharmakaya. Kaya means body. And he tells us in the letter that it is essential for us to come to know the Dharmakaya, not through our conceptual mind, but through our letting go. There's a very beautiful poem that is in our sutra book and that we read in the Zen world. It was written by Daiyo Kokushi and it's called On Zen. There is a reality even prior to heaven and earth. Indeed, it has no form, much less a name. Eyes fail to see it. It has no voice for ears to detect. To call it mind or Buddha violates its nature. For it then becomes a visionary flower in the air. It is not mind, nor Buddha. Absolutely quiet, and yet illuminating in a mysterious way, it allows itself to be perceived only by the clear-eyed. It is Dharma, truly beyond form and sound. It is Tao, having nothing to do with words. Wishing to entice the blind, the Buddha has playfully let words escape his golden mouth. Heaven and earth are ever since filled with entangling briars. Oh, my good worthy friends gathered here, if you desire to listen to the thunderous voice of the Dharma, exhaust your words, empty your thoughts, for then you may come to recognize this one essence. The Dharmakaya is one of the bodies, we say, of the Buddha. Thay also refers to two other bodies of the Buddha in his letter. The Sambhogakaya, he calls it the retribution body. I thought that was really interesting. He calls it the retribution body. Sometimes it's called other things. So the Dharmakaya is represented by Vairocana, who I introduced, talked about earlier, who's the Buddha that expresses the Avatamsaka Sutra and the seven attributes of the ideal posture for meditation. It is the pure and clear, the empty body of the Buddha. The Sambhogakaya is represented by Lochana. And Lochana Buddha is feminine. Lochana is considered the wisdom of Vairocana, the wisdom body of Vairocana. And she takes many forms, sometimes wrathful, sometimes peaceful. And she is the manifestation of the earth element. And as any good biologist knows, the earth has wrath, tremendous storms, fire. I remember once in one of our many, many, many trips back and forth to the Root Temple in Honolulu. Coming home, flying a red eye home, and flying over the big island of Hawaii, and Kilauea was spewing lava. And, it was dark, so you could see the red lava coming up. And then we flew all the way across the ocean and came in, in southern Washington as the day was breaking, and flew up that chain of volcanoes. And Mount St. Helens it was a time when Mount St. Helens was spewing some ash. And I was so happy. Yeah, the earth is so alive. The earth is so well. She's just doing great, spewing her fire and her ash and blowing her stack and throwing her winds and blowing her hurricanes. It's okay. It's okay. And sometimes, nature is very peaceful. And we say we go to nature to touch peace. There's something so natural, because it is who we are. So Lochana, representing the Sambhogakaya, is the retribution body. And as I said, I was real surprised when I saw that Thay called it a retribution body. And I think in part, when you think of retribution, we We think of what is paying out from actions. So the precepts become really important here, that ethical foundation, that grounding and ethical foundation. You know, and we are so blessed in, you know, to have Thay's wonderful five trainings, mindfulness trainings, trainings in mindfulness. And also I really love how the Buddha originally presented them as five precepts, because it's very clear and very specific. Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't indulge in sexual misconduct. Don't lie. Don't cloud your mind with intoxicants. You know, when we, I mean, so it's really cut and dry, you know. It's not like we can get lost in a lot of words here. It's pretty straightforward. And I know often, you know, when we talk about the five mindfulness trainings, there's all this discussion about what does this mean and what does that mean, and it gets pretty intellectual, pretty heady. And, you know, and a lot of these words, you know, like loving kindness, you know, it's really important to ask, what does that really mean? Loving kindness. Does that mean I say really nice things to you, but right now I really resent the hell out of you? But I'm covering it up because I'm pretty nice. And I'm speaking loving kindness. And then I'm going to get a real good dig in. People write letters like that. Not loving kindness. And deep listening. You know, what does that mean? What does it really mean, you know? If we're not asking ourselves those kind of questions, we are not practicing loving kindness and deep listening. We're getting caught in our ideas, and that's a violation of the precepts. And what comes out of that? Dukkha. A bumpy ride for all of us. The Buddha said that when we make a mistake, when we violate a precept, then we need to really recognize it. And there's only one thing we have to do besides that, is promise we'll never do it again. That's the retribution body. It is the body of compassion. I remember when a very dear woman in the early days at Plum Village asked Thay a question, saying, how do I get rid of all my regrets? All the things that I've done that I regret. And Thay said, you let go of your regrets. And you just vow not to do it again. So it means, you know, we take it to heart when we make a mistake, and we truly make every effort to understand why we are violating that precept. Why? So that we really can make the promise not to do that again. But holding on to regrets is just living in the past. And the past is conditioned. And there is dukkha. precepts also talk about not killing. You know, today, I hope we've all been listening well. And here we live in a resource valley, and we've been hearing the sounds of chainsaws and trees falling. And when we look across the valley, we see lots of clear cuts. And we sit in this room, this beautiful wood. And we look out at the trees, beautiful wood. And we live in our houses like we live in the middle of a tree. When we redid the cottage and, you know, all the sheetrock was taken down, and it was so clear. We were living right in the middle of a tree, right in the middle of a life of a tree. And we write, and these are copies, and there are trees. And so when I hear that chainsaw, and the tree go thud, straight ahead, straight forward. Yasutani Roshi, who was my great-grandfather in the Zen tradition, said whenever he went to a garden, the garden to harvest a carrot, he would go like this as he pulled it out. This is the retribution body. It is the body of compassion. So the precepts encourage us to go straight ahead, straight forward. Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't misuse sex. Don't lie. Don't cloud your mind with intoxicants. And there's one other body at the Buddha. Actually, there's two. There's the Sangha body that Kaiva Jewel spoke about so beautifully yesterday. And then there's also the Nirmanakaya. And the Buddha of the Nirmanakaya is Shakyamuni Buddha himself. It's the transformation body. It is the body of you and me. Recently, we buried my mother's ashes in a very beautiful, quiet cemetery. And when I went to pick out the site where we would bury her, I wanted to put her close to the trees because she loved trees. And I wanted her to be taken up and become a tree, become the trees. And she will. And when we scattered my dad's ashes, he loved the ocean so much. He really liked fishing. And so we took his ashes out to the ocean, and where my mother is looking out to where my dad is. And we scattered his ashes out in the ocean because he would love to be a salmon. And he is. The Nirmanakaya Buddha, being born and being dying and dying. Shakyamuni Buddha, you, me. Even rocks, even mountains, all the manifestations. Always transforming. Always appearing new. Infinitely varied, the vast potential of the Dharmakaya manifesting. These bodies of the Buddha are the unconditional, and the unconditional is not born, nor does it die. It reveals itself anew in each moment. It reveals itself anew in the very midst of being born and dying. And our practice is just to pay attention to that. Let the unconditional manifest. We have to see that. This is the essence of Thay's letter. We have to see this for ourselves. It is the only way the Sangha body is kept alive. And this is not enough. The true middle way, as we read yesterday, is not being, and it is not non-being. It's not conditioned, and it's not unconditional. It's not created, nor is it uncreated. In Thay's letter, he says, "O sincere practitioners, in the world there is birth and death, but there is also the unborn and the undying. In the world there is being and non-being, but there is also no being and no non-being. In the world there is the creator and the created, but there is also that which does not create and is not created. In the world there is the conditioned and the unconditioned, but there is also that which is neither conditioned nor unconditioned." This is at the very end of his letter. He wants us to understand that. It is the point of his letter. Some teachers say the middle way is moderation. Not too much of this, not too much of that. Don't starve yourself too much, don't eat too much. But that's not what the Buddha said. He said that we have to experience for ourselves the unconditioned, undying, no self. And then step forth in the marketplace with empty hands. In the midst of the unconditional, we respond to the conditions at hand. In the very midst of the uncreated, we create something we hope is beautiful. In the very midst of dying, of undying, we are born, we get old, we get sick and we die. We offer stability, peace, and love in the very midst of suffering and confusion. We don't pick any sides. This is the middle way. Because the unconditioned and the conditioned are exactly the same. The Heart Sutra tells us that form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness is exactly form. If you don't understand this, I can't explain it to you. But this is what Thay is telling us to realize for ourselves and to actualize for the sake of all beings. This is the seed, the root, the fruit, and the harvest. And there's nothing there at all. Yet our whole life is nothing other than this vast, indestructible, and ultimately unknowable truth, our true self, our true root, our true temple. A woodpecker, I think, a flicker. Don't miss it.